Welcome to Disrupt Disruption, a series of intimate interviews with global thought leaders and practitioners operating at the intersection of business, leadership, and technology. We're discussing all things innovation and disruption and how to not only survive but thrive in these times of exponentially accelerating change. Trusted by CEOs, founders, and leaders globally for the latest take on business models, methods, culture, and leadership, we cut to the chase, debunk the hype, and get real. You're in great company. I'm your host, Pascal Finette, co-founder of Be Radical. Hey, everybody, Pascal here. We are back with another episode of Disrupt Disruption, and this is a reboot, and I couldn't be happier to have someone very special with us, a dear friend of mine, Dr. Frederick Fehrt. To introduce Frederick, he was Google's first and former chief innovation evangelist, which is where we met, and is the adjunct professor at Stanford University's D School. Very briefly about his incredible achievements at Google, he founded the Google Garage, which is their innovation space. I actually spent quite a bit of time in the garage. He created Google's first innovation laboratory, CSI Lab, launched Google's Future Leadership Institute, the Google School for Leaders, has mentored and led a diverse global community of 600 plus innovation evangelists. And Frederick, first of all, I'm super happy to have you here. But secondly, you left Google. How on earth are you leaving this incredible company?
Hello, hello, my friend Pascal. So great to spend time with you. It's always an honor to speak with you, as I respect you as a human being, as a friend, as an inspiration. And I'm super glad that we can talk. And yeah, let's dive right in. I think it's actually good timing because it's exactly 1 year ago. June 1st, I left Google. I decided that there's bigger things waiting for me, which sounds somehow strange, but I felt that innovation and training tens of thousands of Googlers in an innovation mindset and so forth was an incredible opportunity. It was just one of the best things I could ever dreamed of to do. But at the same time, I felt innovation is for a few, but the future is for everyone, which means that I was more curious now to explore how I can help people around the world develop what I call a future-ready mind state, to help them really not just prepare for the future, but actually shape their own future. And so I decided that, and I shared with a couple of friends at Google and asked around, like, what do you think if I pursue that? And everybody was super excited, heard about this opportunity and so forth. And a day later, I signed also a book deal, which was an incredible opportunity now to actually help, I hope, a lot of people around the world to live a future-ready life. It just feels incredible to be on that learning curve again and explore new things as well.
So you said a whole bunch of things. I want to unpack those. You have been described, not just by me, but many other people, as a future optimist, which I absolutely adore as a title. I would put myself into the same camp without that label. You also said just something I want to dig and double click a little bit on. You said innovation is for the few, the future is for everyone. And in the, and this is a little bit of inside baseball. We had a call yesterday to talk a little bit about what do we want to talk about today. And in that call, you mentioned this already, and it triggered for me this interesting quote. There's a quote from Charles E. Kettering who said, "I'm interested in the future because I expect to spend the rest of my life in the future," which I really like. Say a little bit more. Someone who has worked in innovation, I mean, that was your life for whatever, good 13 years or 12 years at Google. It is your life to a certain extent, clearly, in your work at Stanford University. And now, and we should make sure that people know this, you're advising some of the largest companies in the world on this mind state of being future ready. Say a little bit more of what do you mean the future is for everybody, but innovation is only for a couple few.
Pascal, the interesting thing is that when we look into the future, some people are excited about it, and I count both of us into that category. We can't wait to live in the future. I read kind of like your predictions and kind of like how you view technology being a big driver of innovation and so forth. But I also speak a lot of, with humans around the world around how they feel very excited about the future and can't wait to live in a future because they all feel the future is going to be a better one, right? Mm-hmm. But there's also another group of people that are anxious about the future. They fear the future, literally. They tell me they want to live in the past, right? They want to either kind of like stay where they are or bring the times back from the past. And for me, that's not an option because I believe that everything will be better in the future because it's in our hands. We are, what I feel, in control of shaping our own future. Mm-hmm. Technology brings us into the future, but our mind state, right? Our way of how we view the world decides how this future will look like. And so I'm tremendously excited just to help people to also feel very excited about the future because we have an opportunity to do things better, simply put. And you can look at everything around the world that can be not just imagined better, but actually can be done better as well. And so that's really what I want to focus on. And you mentioned an interesting quote, and I think there's another quote that we both kind of like share a lot, which is the future cannot be predicted, but the future can be invented. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of times when talking to people in large organizations, in startups, governments, and so forth, most people focus on the prediction part, interestingly. People want to know, hey, how does tomorrow look like? How does the next year look like? How does the next 10 years look like? Frederick, tell us, or Pascal, tell us. Yeah. And I'm sure you say the same. We don't have the answer. Right. Nobody has the answer because you just can't predict how the next moment will turn out.
Yeah.
And I think that's okay because we should focus actually on the second part of that quote, which is futures can be invented. Mm-hmm. And everybody can invent their own future because you have a choice and many choices usually on how you make your next move, how you decide your next step, how you write that next email to someone you haven't talked to, how you engage in your relationship, how you conduct your work and so forth. So we all have these choices. And I think I want to help people to realize these choices they have, but also make better choices eventually.
In that vein, I'm curious, and let's do this as a quick sidebar. Everybody I know talks about ChatGPT, AI, large language models, and their impact on the world. And the reactions very much, as you described, they range from being very excited about it to like sheer terror. I'm curious, and we don't need to talk all that much about AI, but I'm really curious, what was your reaction about 6 months ago when ChatGPT hit the scene? What was your feeling?
Yes, like most of these tremendous changes, everyone is in the first couple of seconds experiencing kind of like a shock state, right? Mm-hmm. You're like, when the pandemic hit March 2020 or wildfires here burning in Santa Cruz Mountains, like a mile away from our house, or flooding just recently happened as well, the rain just didn't stop. Or ChatGPT appeared November of last year. All of those things are changes. And we humans usually approach this with a sense of curiosity, but also fear sometimes, literally, kind of like we're sometimes just stifled, to be honest. But I, over the many years, try to train myself to shorten that time where something happens, a change mm-hmm. occurs, and how I respond to it. And so you can actually train that, which is amazing, right? Our brains are like these magical tools that we can train, like our bodies. And so for me, whenever a change is happening, I'm trying to immediately look for the opportunity. And in ChatGPT, you don't have to look very much or very long, right? I was super excited to see what's happening there. And I remember a couple of months before the launch, I was with you actually in a magazine with Sam, founder of OpenAI. Yeah. And so we knew kind of like what's on his mind and what he's thinking about the future and so forth. So I was somehow expecting that something magical will appear in the world. Mm-hmm. At the same time, I saw tremendous opportunities for everyone. The first thing I did was actually sharing with my mother. My mom is a very curious, open-minded person. And so it was a fascinating conversation we had about the opportunities, but also about what potentially can happen in the world. Right. Because that technology for me is something where it's more than the iPhone moment, which a lot of people say, right? Because mm-hmm. not everyone could afford an iPhone.
Right.
Now we have a moment where everyone has access to a very powerful tool that allows you to do amazing things. And it's an even more powerful moment. So it's something related to like discovering fire, and somebody's now running around the torch coming out of a cave, and people are, you know, burning their hands, but all that's also at the same time seeing lots of opportunities, what can be done with it. So it was, again, like all of these changes, a moment where I just look for the opportunity immediately, and I'm curious what we as humanity can do with it.
You said something just now, which really makes me incredibly curious, and I'm pretty sure every listener to this podcast will ask themselves the same question. You said you can train this. And of course, you're writing a book about this. You're writing a book about future readiness and the mind state. How do I train this? How do I become like you?
Yeah, it's not so much becoming Frederick. It's, for me, five dimensions I explore in the book, which really over the past years have become clearly the most vital pieces of being future ready. Mm-hmm. And those five are things you can cultivate, you can train, right? Mm-hmm. First thing is optimism, which I just shared. Mm-hmm. Second one is openness. The third dimension of that future mindset is curiosity. And we have experimentation and empathy. So these five, for me, mm-hmm. kind of like clearly define a future-ready mind state. And I mean that when you try to really cultivate these five dimensions, literally how you view the world, I see that you have a chance to actually shape a better future moving forward, better future for yourself and a better future for everyone. Mm-hmm. And I think that's very powerful because there's two things that are interesting. The first thing is everyone has these already built in. Mm-hmm. So we have a sense of optimism, some more, some less, but we generally as a species of human beings, we are optimistic sometimes. Mm-hmm. Openness, curiosity. Actually, we are born as very curious people, a sense of experimentation, trying things out. And during the pandemic, we saw a peak of everyone experimenting with their work, with their relationships, with everything, how we shopped and so forth, how we educate students and so forth. And empathy. We all have a sense of empathy. But what I want to do is I want to elevate all of these dimensions so that you truly, whenever something happens, any situation, that you can tap into these to then see a better future for yourself and create the better future for yourself to move forward. Mm-hmm. I think that's something very powerful. You asked that question, how we can train that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the book is a very practical guide that allows you to do these exercises that help you to train your mind in being future ready. So you don't have to go in like a 10-day meditation retreat as meditating 10 hours a day, which I did. Or you don't have to do cold plunging every morning after you get up. These can be done. They can be helpful. And we have the science and research behind those things. But there's easier ways we can train ourselves in these dimensions of a future mind state. And I want to give everyone access to that.
If you can give us a sneak peek of any one of those five dimensions, someone who's listening to this right now and saying, man, I'm burning, I want to try this out. What would be a practice? What would be a tool they can deploy tomorrow to become more future ready?
Absolutely, yes. So let's maybe use a metaphor. A metaphor for me is maybe your inbox. We all have email inboxes. Some of us live in it, unfortunately, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. But in the inbox, you receive different emails every day. It might be things that occur as changes in your personal relationships. It could be changes in your professional circumstances, like getting a promotion, mm-hmm. being laid off, to be honest, and so forth. Health changes, you get a notification from your doctor or something happened in your family. Financial changes, geographical changes, lifestyle changes, you name it. All these things appear in your inbox. And now when you apply these five dimensions of a future-ready mind state, you can already see, if you're using, for example, open, you're open to exploring all of these emails mm-hmm. and just trying to see what is in that email, what's the situation that is described. Mm-hmm. Let's say changes in your professional circumstances, you're being laid off. Optimism then can be applied while you say, like, okay, I got laid off, which happened to, you know, 12,000 of my colleagues just recently. And speaking to some of them, they already saw the opportunity immediately, because they said, Frederick, to be honest, after a couple of days, I think this is the greatest opportunity in my life, because now I can focus on something that is truly important and meaningful for me. So they practiced looking for the opportunity in that email in your inbox that was basically saying you don't have a job anymore. And so I believe it's the only way forward, because you can't change the situation. We all know these emails that arrive that have changes in your personal relationship, health changes, financial changes, and all of those changes, they can't be changed. They are these situations, but what we can control is our response. And so probably the first thing you can practice yourself is becoming aware, how do I respond to these things? Am I like angry and kind of like right back immediately? Am I stepping back? Maybe go for a quick walk. What's my response to these? And becoming aware of that, I think, is the first great exercise you can do, because then becoming aware helps you to also be maybe more thoughtful about how you respond and maybe look for the opportunity in these changes.
Hmm. Curious to hear, how do you overcome this, like the little devil on your shoulder? I see a lot of people, when we talk about optimism and openness, they exhibit this on the surface level. And then they very quickly fall into this, yeah, but the world is terrible and climate change and just look what's happening in Russia and the Ukraine. How do you overcome this niggling voice in your head?
I'm not arguing that these changes are not happening, right? I think we have to recognize that there are terrible things that are happening all the time. They're happening to us as individuals. They're happening to us being in our professional roles. They're happening to us in our relationships. They're happening around the world. Bad things happen. And I think we need to recognize that. Mm-hmm. But how do you move forward? Are you kind of like complaining a lot, right? And we both know like lots of people who just can't stop complaining, right? Mm-hmm. It's just a series of complaints about anything, finding the reasons like why this happened and complaining that it happened and so forth. Mm-hmm. For me, that's not a valid strategy. The best strategy for me is recognizing that a problem appeared and a change appeared, and then finding the opportunity to actually move forward and create something valuable out of that. Because otherwise, you literally lock yourself in your room, you pull the pillow over your head or the blanket, and you're stuck. Mm-hmm. And I want to help people to get unstuck. I want them to throw away the pillow, get the blanket off you, and move into action mode. Like, what can I do now?
Yeah.
Where's the opportunity for innovation? Where's the opportunity for change? Because I believe that's the only way we can actually solve these big problems that are right in front of us.
If you don't mind me sharing an anecdote of an experience we both had. So we were both invited to a lunch with the former German Minister of Economics, Altmaier. And it was this beautiful lunch in Silicon Valley. Ironically, he came to Silicon Valley to see self-driving cars, which I already thought was kind of a weird thing to do, coming from Germany, the country where cars are truly elevated to a whole different level. But fair enough, whatever. And we had this like around the table conversation, and you made this really funny comment. You said like, all right, so 2 + 2 = 5. And then Altmaier immediately jumped up and said, this is wrong, Frederick. And tell us a little bit about, like, I thought it was a really funny thing, but you did this, of course, on purpose, that 2 + 2 = 5. But so why did you do this? And what was your reaction to his reaction?
Yeah, I remember that situation. It was in Palo Alto, and we sat around this big, large table with lots of brilliant minds coming from all different parts of Silicon Valley, also journalists, some other politicians there as well. And I usually like to show people how they think by giving them an experience. And so for me, it was very important, but it also was risky because I didn't know the reactions, obviously, because we haven't practiced that. And so what I did is I invited everyone in the room, and we were about 40, 45 people sitting in this room. I invited everyone to close their eyes. Mm-hmm. And we can do that right now, right? Just closing your eyes for a moment. Mm-hmm. And then I started, 2 + 3 = 5, 4 + 3 = 7, 5 + 4 = 10. And then immediately, Mr. Altmaier was, oh, there's a mistake.
Yes.
And I said, like, wait a second, I have one more. And then yeah. I said, 2 + 2 = 4.
Yeah.
And so I gave 4 equations, and on purpose, one was wrong.
Right.
And it was just fascinating because he was the first person to yell out loud, there's a mistake, right? Frederick, right. You made a mistake.
Right.
And I said, exactly that's the way we think. That's ingrained in our way of thinking, is that we have that negativity bias, right? Mm-hmm. That's the description of it. And it's based on our evolution. Since the dawn of humankind, we were trained in a way to think that way. We were browsing around in the desert and in the bushes. We had to look for the mistakes in our environment because that literally helped us to survive. You had to recognize the danger first, because if you had that advantage and had that negativity bias, you were actually protecting yourself and you protect the whole community by telling them, hey, there's a dangerous tiger out there, or this berry could be poisonous or something like that. So you had to spot the mistakes. And it's still ingrained in our way of thinking, which is fascinating, because I think nowadays we need to change. We need to change our way of thinking, because recognizing that there were 3 equations that were correct, so it's 75%, right? There's more right than wrong.
Yeah.
Was not what was shared. Nobody mm-hmm. said, hey, Frederick, great job. You did more right than wrong. It's just fascinating when you translate that into the innovation space and we talk about new ideas. You mentioned ChatGPT, right? Or you mentioned self-driving cars or stuff like that. Everybody's looking for the mistakes first. Everybody's looking for the flaws. Mm. Spotting things that potentially could go wrong,
right,
or already went wrong. That's not helping us to make progress. It's good that we spot these things, yeah, but only sure. focusing on these and say, now we have to stop, can't get it done, or can't get it changed, is not helping us. We have to build on the opportunity that there's a couple of things that are working out, so let's continue. Let's try to make these even better. And I think it's always the yay-sayers, kind of like the people who said, hey, great, there's something working out clearly. Mm-hmm. Let's make progress. Let's move forward. And it's not kind of like the people who only focus on the mistakes first that actually help us make progress. And so it was a fascinating experience. And I still remember that it perfectly worked out to demonstrate how the negativity bias is hindering us to explore the opportunities in every new innovation.
It also landed you a very good headline. I remember this in a German business journal, as there were journalists with us at this day. I want to zoom out from here a little bit, because what you just described makes me think about education. You've got 3 children of your own. You teach at Stanford University, clearly one of the best education institutions in the world. You also, together with your wife, run a nonprofit organization, Tüftelei, which brings makerspaces to kids and schools. I'm curious to hear from you, as you're thinking about future readiness. Clearly, we need to get future readiness to our children. How do you think about this? What do we need to teach children? How is it probably different to what we as adults need to unlearn, I guess, and relearn? Say a little bit about how you're seeing, like, what do we do with our children?
Such a great question. And it's a question that is truly, as you mentioned, on my mind a lot, right? How can we reimagine education? Mm-hmm. It has been on my mind for quite some time, because my PhD was actually in that field, where I tried to develop and design a new approach to education, recognizing that technology is a powerful tool that we actually should use more in education. Mm-hmm. And so it was way back in the times when the first podcast came out, when Web 2.0 was hip, weblogs and wikis and all of those things were tools that were just emerging. And for me, I saw a tremendous opportunity to include those tools in education, in schools, universities, and so forth. Fascinating. At that time, nobody was interested. Everybody told me, hey, our education is working, right? We still don't need technology. We still have a teacher in the room teaching students their knowledge, and they need to recite it in a test, which was the education system back then and still is in most of the places in around the world, till the pandemic hit. And for me, again, realizing that this is the best opportunity now to reimagine education, because everybody's forced now, starting from teachers, parents, students, to really rethink what education actually is and how we can teach our children. And for us, we started a small experiment here. We actually built our own schoolhouse called the A-School, an A-frame building, simply put together because we wanted to give our kids their own school and their own space, because we as adults have a hard time to work out of our bed or bedrooms, right? Or our kitchen tables, right? And it's the same for children as well. So we wanted to give them their own space. And so I actually designed and helped build this A-School, where our kids every morning walked up a couple of steps, took their school lunch with them, and got online education, right? So our middle one, Joshua, was learning how to read and write purely online. Totally works, right? It's possible, I think, because we also, our three kids are at a public school, and we were lucky because we had really, really good teachers. And they immediately saw the opportunity as well, went on Google Classroom and other tools and technologies that were available, and immediately built a new curriculum and had some interesting experiments they were doing. For example, they used Zoom. And one of the things they did is they basically put the kids into their individual breakout rooms, gave them a task to read something or write something, and they didn't tell them when they will appear. So the kids were not leaving, obviously, because they always felt like, oh, the teacher might show up in the next minute or so, which was fascinating because the students were sitting in front of a computer in their own breakout room doing reading and writing and all these exercises, which was really fascinating. So that's just one of the stories of how I think there was an opportunity to reimagine education. Unfortunately, we missed the opportunity at a larger scale. I think there were pockets around the world that really stayed with using technology in a very effective way in education, but I think we could have done more. And so now I'm trying to really, also with this book, to influence a future curriculum, because I feel if you can teach optimism, openness, curiosity, experimentation, and empathy to children very early on, and make that part of the curriculum, I think you have a tremendous opportunity not just to make these kids future ready, but to give them these mindsets that are really important nowadays, because as we see that writing, reading, math, kind of like all of these subjects are being challenged with technology. And so I think we have to see that as an opportunity to now reimagine how a curriculum could look like for our children, and maybe have a class on creativity and innovation that might be perfectly suited for the next generation to really help us to solve these big problems that are ahead of us.
I love that. Frederick, this is an incredible conversation. I really like the breadth of it and really getting into the mind state of being future ready. Kind of wrapping this, I'd be curious to hear from you for our listeners. What would you recommend as a daily practice for someone who says, I want to become a future optimist, or I want to become a better future optimist, I want to become future ready, I want to change my mind state to become future ready? So what would you do? As like, I'm a big fan of habitual change, like flossing your teeth is a habit. Nobody likes to do it. What do you think is a daily practice? What do you recommend people to do?
It's a great question. So there's many things, obviously, you can do. And I'm a person who loves to experiment with myself as well, trying just many different things. As I mentioned, maybe more extreme things like the 10-day silent retreat, 10 hours of meditation each day, dipping into 3-degree cold water every morning for 4 minutes and 40 seconds, and many other things. I have my daily meditation practice as well, which helps me to just become aware around that question, are you the master of your mind, or is the mind mastering you? Which for me is just fascinating, because most of the time it's the mind mastering you, where we have a hard time even for 1 minute to focus our attention on our breath, which is just fascinating. The simplest thing in the world, just breathing through your nose and breathing out through your nose or through your mouth, is very hard for us to pay attention to. And so one of the things that I might just invite people to do is start with maybe a meditation practice that is just a minute long. Mm-hmm. It's not 10 hours each day, but just that 1 minute that allows you to become aware of your thought, you know, your feelings, how busy the mind is or not, what's your emotional state and so forth. Because for me, a mind state is really the individual's inner attitude that shape their perceptions and guide their responses to situations, interactions, and daily activities. Mm-hmm. So if you can become more aware of how you respond to situations, and coming back to the analogy of or metaphor of your inbox, where like all of these new situations are waiting for you, how do you respond to these? And I think as soon as you realize that between these triggers that we all receive, because things are changing all the time, mm-hmm. and your response, there's a little time, right? And we have control of that time and how we respond to these things. And I think if you can become a little bit more aware, I think you're doing already the best work towards a future-ready mind state. Because it is essentially the mental and emotional framework through which a person views and navigates the world.
Yeah.
So it's simply put how you view yourself and the world. And I think we can do a better job in that so that we truly can shape that future that we want to see happening.
Let me lean into my curiosity, and we will share in a minute. I will ask you to share a little bit how people can find you. We'll talk a little bit more about the book, but let me very briefly lean into my curiosity. So we're Instagram buddies. You've got a wonderful Instagram with lots and lots of really interesting content. And I see people holding up on many pictures when you are in a larger crowd speaking on a stage. I see people holding up what looks like a post-it note with a hole in it the size of a coin. What is that?
Yes, that's one of the exercises I'm prototyping currently. As you can see behind me, I have a couple of prototypes just here of these exercises that help you train your mind to be future ready. And one of the exercises is around radical optimism. And what I do is I give everyone in the audience, it could be an audience of 50 students just recently at Stanford, or like we had over 1,500 people in another audience just recently in Germany. Mm-hmm. And I give everyone a post-it note. And I invite them to use that post-it note in a way they probably have never used it, because I ask them to rip a hole in it. Mm-hmm. And the first thing I mention is that now you have your perspective, your frame on the world. Looking through this frame is something that everybody does all the time. But what's interesting is everyone has a different frame, right? Every hole looks very different, right? Could be a smaller one. It could be like rectangular one, a circle one, and so forth. So everybody has that view on the world already. But what I help them is to first recognize that you have that frame, you hold it in your hand. First, become aware that you have that frame and how you view the world. And then I have a couple of revealing things on my slides that help them to have that aha moment where they say like, now I see the world differently by just changing my perspective. Because that can help you to, again, see an opportunity in every problem. Again, we can't change most of the situations, but what we can change is how we view those situations, our perspective. And so you wear beautiful glasses. I wear sunglasses sometimes. I probably need some glasses soon too. And so everybody wears these glasses in using that metaphor. Everybody has a perspective on how they view the world and how you view other people, how you view other situations, how you basically view the world. And so if you can become aware of what that is, it's called the subject-object move. You look literally at your post-it note and say like, that's how I view the world. And then trying to change that, change the angle, zoom in, zoom out. You have a powerful tool that helps you to really view the world differently. And that changes your mind state.
I love that. Frederick, on that note, tell us a little bit about your book. When will we be able to hold it in our hands? Does it already have a title? And also, for those of you who are interested, and we'll clearly put the links in the show notes, but how can we follow your incredible work? How can we see you speak, see you on social media, etc.?
Perfect. Yes, yes. So the book hopefully will come out beginning of next year.
Awesome.
That's the goal. I'm currently on my last chapter, which is called Dimension X, which is something I won't reveal now. It's something I'm very, very excited about. So it is in the last pages I'm writing. And so far, I'm super excited about it because what I try to do is really three things. The first one is obviously telling a couple of personal anecdotes, just stories that were helping me at Google, at Stanford, but like with the UN and other organizations, just to help people to have that future-ready mind state and develop that. So there's lots of personal anecdotes and stories. The second thing is I'm actually featuring some Googlers that I personally worked with, trained, and help grow this future-ready mindset as well. And so these stories are just incredible, ranging from someone being on mental health leave to then become a world champion deadlifter, another person kind of like also losing their jobs, but then seeing that as the biggest opportunity in their lives to really do something incredible now. And so featuring those Googlers has been just, for me personally, like a great way of reconnecting with those folks, but also at the same time highlighting that literally everyone in the world can cultivate these dimensions of a future-ready mind state. And the third thing is these practical, what I call train your minds, exercises that help you to also grow that future-ready mindset. And I think everybody, you know, can use those activities on a daily basis in different circumstances, wherever they are. And so that's, for me, as an educator and a person who loves to reimagine education, it's something very powerful, I think, that I want to give people access to. So I'm tremendously excited. I hope people are excited too. You can find me on all the popular platforms. I'm trying to share a little bit more about what I'm finding in what I'm finding out about the future, but also how we can prepare ourselves for the future. And I'm sharing personal anecdotes, personal experiences, and experiments I'm doing as well. And so please follow along.
Frederick, absolutely phenomenal to have you here on the podcast. I'm stoked for your book. We will clearly send this out to everybody we know. I personally can't wait to read it. In the meantime, I will follow and we will all should follow your work. You're very generous with sharing your insights on those platforms. So highly encourage everybody to follow Frederick. Thank you so much. This was an absolutely incredible conversation about becoming future ready and really altering your mind state to be future ready and be an optimist about the future, because there is a lot to be optimistic about in the future. Frederick, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Pascal. I'm again like a big fan of your work. Thanks for being so generous in sharing how technology also will help us move into the future. Your daily, weekly, monthly insights that you're sharing are super valuable, I think, for everyone. And again, I just really like that we as friends, we are both future optimists, but we also can't wait to live in the future. And so I think that's something very powerful as a mind state, to just have that excitement about the next moment, the next day, whatever the future will hold. Because I truly believe that we have a little bit more control if we cultivate that future ready mind state of what's going to happen. And we're going to have a little bit more choices as well. So thanks everyone for listening, and see you in the future.
On those words, thank you so much. Hey, it's Pascal. Thanks for tuning in on this episode of Disrupt Disruption. If you want more, check out the other episodes we have on this podcast. And if you liked it, do us a favor. Go on your podcasting platform of choice, iTunes, Google Play, whatever it is, and leave a quick review. It helps tremendously with getting the insights from our guests out into the world. If you have any questions, send me an email. You can reach me at pascal@finet.com. Thank you so much for listening, and I will hear you here soon. Thank you.